Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm going to be talking about empowered popular feminism and popular misogyny with its author, Sarah Benet-Weiser, who is a professor of media and communications and head of department at the London School of Economics, Department of Media and Communications. Yes, I've got that right. Excellent. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is an unbelievably great book, and it's both, you know, really interesting. It's a great read. And considering the process of writing academic books takes ages, it couldn't be more sort of immediate, relevant, and more kind of at the moment. And I wonder if we could start maybe with asking where the book sort of fits in with your academic career and your thought to date, and how is it that you've written a book that's just so perfectly timed?
Sure, and thank you for the kind words. This is my fourth book, and I generally have chosen topics to write on and subjects to write on that are kind of marginalized in some way. So my first book was about women, and it was about women in beauty pageants and thinking through that. And then I looked at kids and the way in which networks, television networks, created children as a particular kind of brand. And then I wrote a book on brand culture, where I kind of was asking the question, what does it mean? What does it mean that we live our lives through brands? What's at stake there? And what should we do about it, if anything? And one of the things I was doing in that book, one of the chapters in that book, was a look at the company Dove, from the 50s through the 80s through the current moment. And that book was 2012. And I really became interested in the ways in which certain kinds of corporations like Dove, but now like CoverGirl and Audi and Chevy, harness feminist rhetoric as a way to sell products. But it's not just simply kind of inserting a feminist message. There are programs behind it. Dove has a self-esteem fund, and there's websites. It's about co-production with consumers. So I really became interested in how it is that feminist messages in the 21st century were being used as a way to sell products, but also as a way to sort of spread a message about feminism. So that's how this book started. And so I started looking at all of the the different messages, feminist messages that you see all around you. And I have to say that for me, like many people, one of the formative moments was actually watching Beyonce at the 2014 Video Music Awards from MTV with the word feminist lit up behind her. And that became this moment where people said, oh, this is a zeitgeist, and, you know, this feminism is having a moment. And so I started, I'm a media studies scholar, so I started looking at different media forms and platforms and where these feminist messages were cropping up. And so the book began as a book about popular feminism. And I was talking about it in terms of popular because it was accessible, broadly accessible on media platforms. It was also about a certain kind of popularity. It was a happy feminism. It was affirmative. It wasn't alienating or angry. It was about confidence and self-esteem. And I also see popular culture as a terrain of struggle. So for those three reasons, I began to think about it as popular feminism. And every time, literally without exception, every time I started to do research into one of these Tumblr pages or Twitter feeds or corporate ads, I found this incredibly hostile and increasingly hostile and increasingly vicious response to it. And so the book is really, the main argument of the book is that I don't think that we can understand what popular feminism means in this particular moment right now without also analyzing it and positioning it in relationship to what I began to call popular misogyny, which is popular for some of the same reasons that feminism is. It's accessible, it's networked, and it's about a terrain of struggle.
I mean, as a kind of ground clearing exercise, it'd be quite useful if you could say a little bit about how you define those two things. I mean, you've gestured towards it already, because that struggle both sort of animates the book, but also quite usefully, I think, allows the book to go beyond just a discrete analysis of, say, advertising or empowerment programs or this kind of thing, and really foregrounds the sense of actually, there is progress and backlash, there are ambivalences here. So those two, I think, key terms maybe need a bit of definition.
Sure. And to your last point, this is a conjunctural analysis. So I'm looking at different media forms, different media platforms, as well as the political economy and the structural ground on which these media platforms make sense and take shape. And so for popular feminism, I really position it as having this kind of moment after what many, media scholars have talked about in terms of post-feminism. And I've done that too. And that, post-feminism is this sensibility, as Roz Gill would say, that where you recognize that feminism exists, but you don't need it anymore. And so it's all about girl power. It's about, you do what you want, you can objectify yourself, And I started thinking about the way I define popular feminism is that popular feminism is in some ways a response to post-feminism, in that if post-feminism was right, if we don't need feminism anymore, why are there such stark inequalities? Why is it? Why do we have Me Too? Why do we have such widespread sexual harassment? Why is there a pay gap? Why aren't there more female CEOs? So this moment for me, popular feminism is an embrace of feminism. It's a recognition that structural inequalities exist, gender inequalities exist, and that we should try to do something about them. That said, and there are different popular feminisms. Mm-hmm. The one I highlight in the book is one that really targets individual women. And so it is about, popular feminism for me is about saying to someone through a blog or through a Tumblr page or through an Instagram, you should just be confident. You're beautiful. You can do whatever you want. Just say that to yourself and be confident. Lean in, get over imposter syndrome, that kind of thing. And if you don't, then it's nobody's fault but your own. And so popular feminism for me is this curious recognition that there is structural gender inequality, but that the only way to resolve it is by individual women doing individual things. So in that sense, it follows a very kind of typical corporate model of addressing people as consumers. Popular misogyny is, again, it shares some of these same characteristics, but it is, I try to talk about it as more than, kind of the conventional definition, which is like a basic hatred of women. Instead, I talk about it as something that is more nuanced and really importantly networked. So it's networked across different, modes of communication and modes of media. So men's rights activism has been around since the 1970s, but it wasn't until the last 10 years where it really grew into a global network because of social and digital media. The early kind of efforts of men's rights organizations were often things like paternity rights or child custody things. Now what men's rights organizations are about are really about making sure that everyone knows that whatever problems men have, it's because of women. It's because of feminism.
I mean, it's quite easy to conceive of popular feminism. I mean, many of the sort of discussions and debates we see in popular media draw on some of the ideas of popular feminism and some of the critiques of it. But I guess the popular misogyny, maybe it'd be quite useful to have an example of that. So early on in the book, you talk about the Don't Be That Girl kind of campaign. And it struck me as really interesting because exactly as you'd said, you know, these, on the one hand, kind of individualized, you know, almost drawn ideas about neoliberal feminism and you know, responsabilization, individualization are there. But also there is something kind of slightly different going on with this kind of aggressive assertion of this is women's fault.
Yes.
So it'd be, if you could like sketch out that.
Sure. I mean, so what I argue in the book is that there's a kind of common thread that that I think shapes and offers logic to both popular feminism and popular misogyny. And that is the thread of these twinned discourses of injury and capacity. And so for popular feminism, again, the injury is a structural one. Mm-hmm. It's general sex, it's centuries of sexism, right? And so capacity, popular feminism sees itself as offering the capacity to individual women to overcome those structural injuries. So the injury is structural and the capacity is something where, again, you just lean in or you are just confident. Popular misogyny takes these discourses of injury and capacity and mirrors them back to feminism. But as I talk about in the book, it's like a funhouse mirror. They're distorted, they're transmuted. And what they do is they position injury as injury to men. And that injury is caused by women, by marginalized communities, by non-heteronormative people, by refugees, by immigrants, by anyone who is encroaching on a kind of basic patriarchy. That's the injury. And the capacity I see, and this is where I think popular misogyny needs to be taken both seriously and taken differently than in times previous to this, the capacity is about recuperation. It's about restoring patriarchy as if it's really gone away, right? But then it takes place, it takes shape in violent ways. So you've seen misogyny forever. You haven't seen women who dare to talk about video games and the problematic representations of gender getting death threats and rape threats, right? You've seen misogyny as a kind of, you know, low level, you know, thing that happens, discourse or remarks that happen in enclosures. You don't see them, you know, spouted off routinely by the president of the United States, right? I mean, so I think that what we need to think, you know, what I'm trying to say here about misogyny is that it's often positioned as an outlier, but it really isn't that different from kind of conventional norms and values. And we're slowly just kind of accepting that, right? And that is a huge problem. So the injury for in terms of popular misogyny is the injury by women, and the capacity is actually a structural one. It is electing heads of state who are known misogynists. And we've seen this with Brazil. We've seen this with the U.S. We've seen this, you know, all over the place. It's the extreme right movements across the globe, which use misogyny not as a tactic, but as part of their agenda. And so kind of capacity to get over the injury that was caused by women is often to fold in misogyny as structure.
I mean, obviously the specter of Trump hangs over the book, but I suppose the thing I liked or found hopeful about the book was the sense of this is a text that will help us analyze and understand Trump that goes beyond economic grievance in the Midwest or something like that, which is I mean, I like political science, but that, you know, tends to be the drier colder sort of set of explanations. It is tricky, as you've gesture towards, the kind of untangle the misogyny and the feminism in your analysis. But I suppose the more kind of interesting or the bits that stood out more to me were the moments where you kind of foregrounded your analysis of popular feminism with obviously some contrasts. And I guess there are maybe two examples we could talk about. One might be, and you mentioned this term quite a lot, the idea of confidence. Mm-hmm. But the other one might be ideas about body positivity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a long kind of tradition of critiquing through media and communication sociology, these ideas about body positivity campaigns and, you know, corporate uses of them. And it'd be interesting to hear your sort of take, I guess, on that before we start talking about things like confidence.
Sure. I mean, I think body positivity, the Love Your Body movement, we see it everywhere. It's in apps. So there's tons of, body positivity apps so that you can just look at your phone and make yourself feel better about your body. You can see a little bit of it in advertising where people say, you know, where you have someone who is not conventionally thin on the cover of a, you know, and this is body positivity. You see it in corporate ads. You see it on, in Instagram, and you see it kind of everywhere. So it's body positivity is sort of, or Love Your Body is sort of a movement, right? I think that the way I think about it within popular feminism is it also is something that is about your body. Right. So I can look at it. I can look at, you know, read an inspirational Instagram every day about that is about like making me feel better about my body. And the problem is that it doesn't actually touch on why it is that women, so many women feel so horribly about their bodies in the first place. So it keeps intact this idea that there is one ideal that is usually thin and white and tall and conventionally beautiful. It keeps that intact, but it says we can widen this, you know, this the parameters here so that other women can feel positive about their bodies. Feeling positive about their bodies isn't a way to stop getting us to think that we are defined by our bodies in the first place, you know? So there's, you know, it's tricky, it's complicated. And
this is the limits of like Dove's campaign.
Exactly. You know, Dove's campaigns are, you know, they say they, you know, the most of them say that the problem with self-esteem and the problem with confidence lies within you. You don't think you're beautiful, you think you're fat, you think this. And so it is about working on the individual. It is a corporation. It works on consumers as individuals. So it's about you telling yourself and you somehow just are, you know, becoming confident. You take confidence classes and they are everywhere online, you know, and so it's really about the individual woman rather than, again, the structural ground that encourages a particular kind of mindset that some bodies are more beautiful than others. And that's where we have to go. We have to, and also just to kind of question why it is that we're constantly still, if feminism has done its job, why are we constantly still evaluating ourselves and being evaluated by our bodies?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Again, you kind of touched on the confidence ideas, and that I think was something where this dialectic between feminism and misogyny really came strongly through, actually, with, you know, the same sort of individualized and, you know, kind of responsibilized set of practices about transforming confidence play out with things like the seduction community.
Yeah.
And it'd be useful to maybe have that as a contrast to not just the kind of confidence and body positivity, but to kind of show how really the same dynamics are at play here, mm-hmm. and the same sorts of structural failures, I suppose, mm-hmm. and individualized trends.
Sure. I mean, I think that one of the things that I try to talk about, that I try to flesh out in the book, is that within popular feminism and within popular misogyny, there are these themes like confidence, but they're sort of like empty signifiers. They kind of hang there. So for popular feminism, I looked at hundreds of confidence organizations and trying to think, what are we training girls to be confident about? Is it about their bodies? Is it about their minds? Is it about learning to code? Why do we need to be confident? And it turns out that confidence organizations in this moment of neoliberal capitalism, are really about training and teaching women and girls to be confident in the workplace. So it is about teaching them, or the goal is to become a better economic subject, right? It has a feminist inflection, but it's not about being a better feminist. It's not about challenging patriarchy. It's about how to succeed in patriarchy, right? So confidence for women within popular feminism, I really see as about, you know, learning to become part of the corporate world and a success in the corporate world. That's what Sandberg's, you know, book was all about. Yeah. That's what all that is about. The Confidence Gap, which is another best-selling book, was also about how men feel more confident at work than women. And that's why women can't, progress in the workplace. So it's really centered around economic confidence. For misogyny, within these kind of popular misogyny, this popular misogyny context, there is also a confidence problem. It's not economic, though. Even though there are many men who are, you know, working class, that, you know, who could use confidence in terms of being a better economic, or, you know, a quote, better economic subject, the confidence issue for misogyny is about being emasculated. It is directly related to masculinity, and it is seen as something that feminists in particular, women in general, but feminists in particular, have taken away from them. So it's about masculine self-confidence. And so that's why you have things like the seduction community and the pickup artist industry, which literally trains men to, you know, figure out ways to pick up women, because somehow sex, heterosexual sex, is something that is seen to be owed, you know, for men by women. And when men are not successful sexually, then it is something that they often blame on women. So confidence here is about learning how to manipulate women into bed with you, basically, in terms of the seduction communities and pickup artist industries. And I will say that you mentioned structural failures, that you can see increasingly also a response by men who have been told if they just follow these steps, if they just dress the right way and use the right words and do the right thing, they can have sex with anyone they want. That's obviously not true, right? Because we're human beings. And when they fail, the failure sometimes, and unfortunately, tragically, increasingly, the failure itself is expressed in violence towards women. So it's, you know, it's not violence towards patriarchy, which is a context that enforces competition among men in the first place, but it's against and targeted towards women. So you have the incel movement, and there's been like 5 mass killings by people who identify as incel, involuntarily celibate, because they have been rejected by women and because they felt that they did not deserve that rejection. So the confidence here is about masculine confidence for men, and for women, it's about economic confidence.
But what's interesting as well, I think, and this comes through in the book as well, is people are still getting paid, you know, so the kind of the sense of this as being, an ideological or political problem, you know, as you've mentioned, you know, there is a kind of a pickup industry, there's a seduction community, and this is not just, you know, kind of sharing things on message board. This is coming to seminars. This is, you know, quite expensive as far as I can see, you know, investments. And, you know, you've got on the one hand investments in particular kinds of self-improvement that are highly problematic in my view, but also investments in the kinds of products that we've seen with I mean, it sounds really awful to compare Dove to men's rights activists.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, one of the things the book is trying to do is sort of say there are similar dynamics here.
There are similar dynamics, and it's true. And what I try to make clear in the book too is that these are all on a continuum, right? And you don't want to necessarily compare Dove to the pickup artist industry, but there are similar logics there. And some of the similar logics are about popularity, are about accessibility. And then you have these themes like self-esteem and confidence and competence. I have a chapter on technical competence. And so you can see that there are themes that are really shared. You mentioned earlier this campaign, Don't Be That Girl. And that's a really clear example about how these themes are shared and how they're distorted with popular misogyny. So this was a campaign by a coalition of rape activists and campus activists for college women about date rape. And so they put up a bunch of posters that said, you know, just because she's drunk doesn't mean she's giving consent. You know, don't be that guy, right? So don't be that guy was the name of the campaign. And a men's rights organization took those literal images, the same exact images on those posters, created their own posters and said, but basically made it about false accusations of rape, right? So just because it was bad sex doesn't mean it was rape. Don't be that girl, right? So they use the same logics and just in a kind of distorted way. But yet they're both popular feminism and popular misogyny exist in neoliberal capitalism, and also they circulate and are heard and seen on what I call an economy of visibility, which is about this the kind of endless circulation of these images and endless kind of overlaps between different media platforms where visibility of feminism and visibility of misogyny becomes the end rather than a route to or means to an end.
The one, I suppose, at least in my reading, this might be wrong, but I suppose the one moment where that interrelationship didn't quite hold true was thinking about tech. Mm-hmm. And I think the analysis of empowerment of women in tech, that really, you know, sort of made sense within the overall arc of the book. But it struck me that the reaction against that was almost beyond this, kind of similar, you know, lines of thought, similar rhetoric and stuff like that. So it'd be interesting to hear your kind of analysis of the tech industry in the book. At least in my reading, the kinds of the moment of things like Gamergate, there was no reciprocity at all. That was a really kind of, you know, the idea of sort of placing the responsibility for learning to code and thus combating structural sexism really was outweighed by, you know, hate campaigns, mm-hmm. SWAT teams to people's houses in response
right.
to what were effectively, you know, very minor kind of demands for different sort of characters in online RPGs and
yeah.
things like
yeah.
this. So
yeah.
so yeah, it'd be interesting to hear your sort of analysis of tech and that and how that balance works.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, you know, also the reason why I separated these into kind of themed chapters is that the dynamic, I feel like the dynamic is always there,
yeah.
but it's not always even.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
you
yeah.
said, it's not, the campaign I just mentioned, the Don't Be That Girl, that's like a beautiful research object for a scholar, right? Because it's literally using the
yeah.
same images. Within the tech community, I'm basically what my argument is that in there is that if you accept that technology industries have either become or are becoming or the kind of center of power, right? Kind of shifting away from financial culture to tech culture, which we can see just by looking at companies and who owns them and the amount of wealth that are owned by those companies, then you have it's a, you know, tech The tech industry encourages a different sort of masculine position, a different sort of masculine subject position. And in many ways, these are, you know, kind of this, what some people have called geek masculinity. Yeah. These are men who have been bullied or challenged based on their masculinity, right? Throughout childhood, before the, you know, before the tech industry explodes. Now they're adults, they're smart, they have good, well-paying jobs in the center of power, and they feel like they've earned it. And so when women dare to encroach on that terrain, the response is swift and it's vicious. And it is really, like you said, it is like filled with hate. I mean, it is rape threats and death threats and swatting people. And so, you know, what I argue in the book is that this is about, more than anything else, this is about sort of you've lived a sort of marginalized life in terms of dominant masculinity. You've achieved the things that masculine subjects are supposed to achieve: wealth, position, a good house, you know, a good job and everything else. But you still don't have what is apparently part of that package, which is, you know, a woman or the, heterosexual female attention and that sort of stuff. So there's a kind of culture of hatred about what, again, what people feel that they are owed. This is where you get a lot of incels, right, in that community, or this is often the community. I mean, he speaks to a large community, but Jordan Peterson speaks to a lot of people in this area too, because it's like, you know, he gives this kind of common sense advice about, you know, clean your room and everything else, but then says
lobsters,
yeah, and then says that in order for it really it to be fair, we need to have enforced monogamy,
yeah,
right? So kind of pairing people up. So I think that the threat to geek masculine communities is felt more because they have been denied privilege. And even, you know, they've been given privilege because they're male, but because they're geek, you know, smart or whatever. And so when they achieve a certain position, the fact that women could threaten that position is kind of overblown and exaggerated. And that's what I think happened in Gamergate. I mean, you know, again, you know, someone made a video game of Anita Sarkeesian because she had a video program that talked about problematic representations of women in video games. That's not even an argument, you know? I mean, it's not like, you know, she's great, but she wasn't really going out on a limb. And the response was so vitriolic and so over-exaggerated that it really made me kind of dig deeper into that relationship to see what it is that is so threatening about women entering this field.
The traditional kind of conclusion to, you know, really weighty critical analysis is always some gesture towards a kind of, you know, hopefulness or, you know, some practical advice on change, etc. But obviously the moment that we're in and the moment of the book, I mean, in some ways, it would have been ludicrous if you were like, and here's 10 ways to solve all this.
Yeah.
So I suppose as a kind of concluding comment, maybe I've got two questions. One is, if you'd say a little bit about the kinds of hopefulness, but also the ambivalence of things like the Women's March and the response to Trump's election. And I suppose actually, you know, after a comparatively good showing in the midterms, you know, there is a slightly different political context than if I'd interviewed you, say, 3 or 4 months ago. But then the other question I've got beyond that kind of coda to the book is where does Empowered analysis go next? You know, what kind of projects do you see coming out of this book? Where we started, there was I kind of sensed an arc through the 4 books you've written. Mm-hmm. You know, is there an Empowered 2 coming or something like this?
That's the mean question, the person what her next project is.
Like, these books take so long to write. They take so long to come out. And then the first thing anyone asks is, oh, so what are you doing now?
Well, the first question first. So just to kind of go back to the beginning, I was writing this book because I was seeing all these things happening, and it was due in November 2016, and then Trump won, And I texted my editor and said, I don't think I can do this because what am I writing for if this happened? And she's an amazing editor and wrote back and said, you have to do this. It's more urgent now than ever. And so I went ahead, you know, and then took another, you know, the whole year to think about what Trump and the kind of specter of Trumpism meant for this book.
I mean, the analysis is true. If Hillary had won as well, you know, like, and I mean, that's what's so powerful about the book. It's not contingent on on whatever it is, you know, 100,000 votes in the Midwest, you know, that this structural analysis would have been true either way. But I guess Trump gives it, you know.
Well, Trump gives it, like, you know, I think in some ways a predictable point, right? And that you're absolutely right. All this stuff has been happening and increasing, and Trump is just a part of that. I mean, the election of Trump is part of the fact that this idea of injury and capacity, and the relationship between popular feminism and popular misogyny is intensely organizing our lives. Make America Great Again is about injury. It's about recuperation. It's about restoration. And that ends up being the kind of logic of popular misogyny. So I think that, that is not something that I'm ambivalent about. I am ambivalent about popular feminism. It's hard for me as a feminist theorist to critique, you know, feminism, you know, messages of feminism. I have a 17-year-old daughter, you know, who considers herself a feminist. I didn't consider myself a feminist when I was 17 because it was not at all something that people would embrace. That's amazing to me. I participated in both, you know, in the two so far since the Trump election, the women's marches, and it was an amazing, affective, powerful experience to see so many women and men gather in solidarity for this. And so I think that is, you know, incredibly important. My hopefulness is that we can't stop there, because what happens is, you know, in the US immediately after the first women's march, we had women silenced in Congress. We had, you know, racist remarks said about female politicians. You had all sorts of ways to stop that power and to stop that sort of incredible visualization of all those hats and all those people. And I think what we need to do is be patient and recognize that something like Me Too is now it's a global mobilization. I'm not sure it's a movement, but it's a global mobilization, and figure out how to not let it end there. And so for me, that's the part where my ambivalence is that we need to, you know, I critique t-shirts that say, this is what a feminist looks like. I have that t-shirt, right? So I'm not saying that there's that I'm not questioning the intentions of women or men who wear that t-shirt. What I'm saying is that what we need to do is look at the social and political and economic conditions that allow that t-shirt to stand in for structural change. And so in terms of my ambivalence, that's it, you know, that's where it lies. And in terms of the midterms, I think that it's a really, like you said, it's a really interesting moment. Now we have to wait. Now we have to wait, and we have to see, you know, there's one thing about bringing women to the table, and I'm all for that. There's another thing about having women help build the table. And it seems like these women might be the ones who want to help build the table. And so I'm hopeful about that. We'll just have to see. And I guess in terms of my next project, I think, you know, I have now written a book about the sort of individualist messages of feminism that garner the most media visibility, that are the most seen, that are happy and positive and affirmative and often related to corporations and selling things. And I think now I would like to do something that is about thinking about other forms of popular feminism that are more structural, and whatever visibility I have to bring those to the surface, because they don't circulate so easily on Twitter or in blogs or, you know, and so kind of figure out a way to participate in these and feminist, popular feminism that is about structural change, that is about global change, not so tied to celebrities and visibility, but rather tied to actual, you know, kind of political action.